Improve your construction projects with real-time insights direct from the site with Procore's easy-to-use platform. Learn more at Procore.com. Procore, software for the people who build the world.
It's Wednesday, the 13th of December, 2023, and this is the last episode of Reconstruction before we all down tools for the Christmas break. I'm David Taylor, and my colleague in the unspeakable Christmas sweater and acrylic Santa hat is Phil Bishop.
Hello.
Of course, our listener can't see you, Phil, so they won't know whether I'm lying or not. But I'm sure you're feeling pretty festive, am I right?
Well, we've got all the decorations up, the tree's decorated, haven't got round to writing any cards yet. I've been a bit stingy this year with the price of postage, but a week ago I thought, I'm not bothering this year, and then I thought, I think I'd better. Gonna upset distant relatives and so on, so go ahead with that.
Yeah, quite.
How about you? Are you ready and organised?
No, not at all. Well, actually, it's the other way around. We've done all the cards, but I haven't got any decorations and I haven't bought a tree. So that'll all happen this weekend when my daughter comes back from university.
Because that's her job, isn't it, of course?
That's her job, yeah. She coordinates all of that. So, that'll happen at the weekend.
Excellent.
So, Phil, normally what we do is talk about what's happened or what news stories have emerged over the past couple of weeks. This time, because it's the last one of the year, I think we're going to have a look at some of the big stories or some of the stories which we think are interesting that have emerged over the past 12 months or past 11 months anyway.
Well, it's been a very eventful year. But before we move on to that, I would just like to do a quick mention of a couple of materials stories that we've run in the past couple of days. First on this morning is, I think, particularly interesting. Australia has become the first country in the world to ban the use of engineered stone to protect workers from silica dust. Engineered stone, I don't know, is travertine an engineered stone? I'm not sure. There are different types of...
I think travertine is a natural stone. Okay. It's a sort of a... Yeah, but I'm not quite sure what they mean by engineered stone. I mean,
all this stuff that is used for kitchen worktops and basin surrounds and so on. And the issue with it is it's fine when it's sitting there and you're, rolling your pastry out on it. It's when you're cutting it to size. And it's the poor kitchen fitters, bathroom fitters who are working with the material... Cut it, silica dust, lethal, as we know, all these lung diseases that silica dust causes. And there's been campaigns by trade unions in Australia and health and safety campaigns and so forth. And the government said, okay, yep, we're going to do it. We've decided we're going to ban it. And it seems, I don't know enough about the Australian system of government, but it's a federal government. And therefore, it has to go through all the different states, territories,
yes,
processes one by one
to ratify
it. So it's not just gone in one, overnight.
Okay,
it's a process, but it's effectively the news story. The headline is "No more engineered stone to be used in Australia to protect the workers."
That's very strange.
Which is interesting, I think.
Yeah, it certainly is, because I mean, will we follow suit? But I mean, is engineered stone any worse than natural stone? I mean, natural stone is basically silica. And a few other things. So presumably there must be silica dust when you're cutting a granite worktop or a limestone one, I'd have thought. Maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it creates more dust.
Yes. So I suppose it ought to have asked the UK Health and Safety Executive for a comment. Maybe I'll drop them an email and see if they've got a line on it. I'm sure they'll refer it to me to a page on their website
that says
precautions to take when cutting stone. I mean, they've had lots of dust campaigns, the HSE here. But it's just other side of the world, a long way away, I know that, but I think it's always interesting to see what other people consider to be best practice in terms of health and safety. So that was an interesting one.
Yeah.
And the second material story, unrelated, not unrelated, is the document that the government produced yesterday, Timber in Construction Roadmap. Government policy to promote the use of construction. Promote the use of timber in construction. And it's basically setting out what needs to be done to increase the use of timber, overcoming concerns about fire safety, overcoming concerns that insurers, lenders and warranty providers have about timber, promoting innovation and high-performing timber, just generally promoting the use of timber and skills, capacity and competency across the supply chain, etc., etc. Also, increasing the supply of it because we import most of our timber. Now, what's curious about this document to me is that it's been published by DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. Now, where they're coming at it from, they don't sponsor the construction industry. I mean, we've got basically the Department for, oh, I can't remember what I think it's called Trade and Industry. It's not Trade and Industry.
It used to be DBIS, whatever the business department is.
They're the people who, you know, run the Construction Leadership Council, for example. They publish, they and the Cabinet Office as well, with their sort of efficiency drives and so on, publish, you know, construction policy roadmaps. And they're the people who try and, you know, get the construction industry doing what they want to do. And then you've got the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, who are in charge of housing and planning, who also have a sort of a regulatory, I guess, oversight over construction. DEFRA is not really a construction sponsorship department.
No.
However, it does sponsor people who grow things.
Forestry.
Exactly that.
Yes.
So this seems to be a bit of the horse before the cart, it seems to me. Or is it the cart before the horse? That's what I mean. And that they're basically saying, we want to promote forestry, therefore let's promote timber in construction. Now, that seems to me completely the wrong way around. I mean, it's not like saying, oh, you know, we want to help onion growers. Let's find new uses for onions and, you know, make motor cars out of onions or something. Because timber is a, you know, great product for certain aspects of construction. Not a problem with that.
Oh, yeah.
But it just seems a weird justification. I mean, the starting point is that we want to plant more trees, so come on, construction, use more wood.
Yeah, I think I have to. I really ought to read this this roadmap document, because it does sound a little bit odd to me, as if it hasn't been thought through. I've written quite a lot about timber over the years and done a bit of work for timber producers or timber product producers. And it's always been my understanding that we simply do not grow enough of the right sort of timber. I mean, if we're talking about structural, you know, timber joists and, you know, beams and stuff like that, the stuff that timber frame houses are made out of, for example, our timber really isn't good enough. And so we have to get the larger, slower growing timber from, you know, Scandinavia, Canada, and places like that. Scotland obviously has some forests, and they produce a bit of timber. But really, I mean, our sawn timber just isn't up to scratch. That's my understanding of it. And what timber we do produce tends to be used more for the production of board products and things like that, like OSB, oriented strand board, which is made out of forest thinnings. I don't know actually what they do with the trees themselves. I mean, the thinnings are the little spindly ones that they take out as the forest grows. I think they probably use the big ones just as telegraph poles. I'm not quite sure, but I don't think that we can do an awful lot with our forestry industry to actually promote the use of wood. We're going to have to import it, not use the homegrown stuff.
Well, you need to read this roadmap, because the government says you're wrong. Yeah. I mean, of course, it all comes from the vested interest. It's the Timber Trade Federation, or Timber Development UK, as they now are, the Forestry Commission, Tree Planters Guild of whatever, and all these sort of people who are behind it all. Yeah. So it's entirely vested interest. But then why wouldn't it be? Who else is going to promote it? But I'm just inherently against the idea of. I mean, I think the people who should decide what the best materials to build with are engineers and architects, and more particularly engineers, I think, but architects as well.
Yeah.
And I would much rather that engineers and architects said, this is what we need to build with, this is what we should be growing more of, or whatever, rather than DEFRA
rather than death
coming along.
Yes,
saying,
quite.
Build with timber. And I made mention in my report of a typically Clarksonian column by Jeremy Clarkson, the automotive journalist turned gentleman farmer, in his Sunday Times column last Sunday, basically saying that, you know, well, stupid idea. The government wants to live in, you know, skiing lodges and Swiss chalets, and actually we should build out of stone because stone's, you know, it's inert. It's not a bad carbon product, and houses built out of stone are much nicer than ones built out of MDF.
Yeah, I'd agree with him on that.
My whole knowledge of construction is founded from childhood, or infancy, I should say, lying in bed being read Three Little Pigs. It's absolutely been drummed into me from an early age that it is much better to build houses out of stone than out of straw or out of wood.
Of wood, yeah. Yeah. All three materials are, of course, used in construction, but I mean, yeah, I think probably stone is the more durable. I know that the timber frame lobby would be up in arms. Well, I mean, Clarkson just likes to poke the bear, doesn't he? And so, you know, obviously they will say that a modern timber frame building still has to conform to the same structural and fire regulations. And building a house out of wood would not put you at risk from collapse or fire any more than it would if it was built out of brick. But I'm not sure I'd like to live in a timber framed house, not in a modern one.
Well,
anyway.
I think actually the document that's come out from DEFRA is less about housing, because timber framed housing are fairly well established, and certainly the roofing trusses and so on.
Yeah,
but they're trying to get taller buildings to be using timber, and, you know, buildings which perhaps don't use timber to be made either out of or with more timber. So it's pushing the use beyond where we are now, I think.
Sure, sure. Well, the Scandinavians do that. I mean, I get regular messages through from Scandinavian timber engineering companies. And they build high-rise buildings out of timber in places like Stockholm and Malmo and places like that. Not sure we could do the same here. Well, I suppose we could if we imported the right timber again, you know, but not with our homegrown stuff.
But let the engineers and the architects decide, not having government telling us what to build out of.
Yeah, quite.
Anyway, I thought those are just a couple of material stories, and we always like a good
building material
story, don't we? No, let's make the main event of this is our last podcast of the year, as you mentioned, 2023. What sort of year has it been for you, David?
Well, yes, as you say, from a construction point of view, a very eventful one. I mean, I don't know if you want to work through the months from January through to December, but I mean, there was some obvious landmarks and big stories emerging during the year. HS2 being truncated by Rishi Sunak during his Tory conference speech. Obviously, was an important one, but that came towards the end of the year. The first one, really, which I noticed, well, it wasn't the first one I noticed, but one which caught my eye particularly was in March, when the Competition and Markets Authority slapped massive fines on 10 demolition companies for anti-competitive behaviour. And that was the first time I'd really, well, I say it was the first time I'd noticed any cartel activity in the construction industry for a long time. There had been others. But it reminded me that this is a perennial problem in the industry. Companies sort of cover bidding, I think is the term, where basically you get together with your rivals, you know, you traditionally in a smoke-filled room, and you agree that certain companies will put in unrealistic bids just so that a favoured company can win the contract.
For a decent price.
For a decent price, yes, exactly. And this is... this is apparently what the demolition companies were doing. I mean, they were big demolition companies as well. I mean, I think nearly all of them
There were eight of the top ten.
Top ten. Yeah, there we are. Eight of the top ten. Yeah. And so there was this cover bidding going on, and some of them, I think there were five companies, were identified as having colluded to an even greater degree. That was Erith, Brown and Mason, McGee, and Scudder. That's only four. Maybe there was another one. But they had some sort of agreement whereby the winning bidder would compensate the others who had colluded to help them win the project by bunging them a few bob. Actually, it was more than a few bob, because I believe one of the compensation payments was £500,000. So, you know, it was really was a stitch up and, you know, sort of cartel activity at its worst. Three directors were banned from acting as company directors for a few years. One at Erith and two at Cantillon, which is another major demolition company. Keltbray, interestingly, Keltbray was one of the companies that was fined. They weren't happy about, well, I don't suppose any of them were particularly happy about it, but they said they are going to appeal because, and this is quite an interesting thing, actually, because the fines were calculated. The fines meted out to each of these companies was calculated as a percentage of their turnover. And now Keltbray I've always thought of as being a demolition contractor, but they've evolved quite a lot in recent years.
They do a lot demolition, more than that, yes.
They do an awful lot more than that. And they said, well, hang on a second, you've based this fine on, you've calculated it as a percentage of our group turnover. And actually demolition, you know, you should be just looking at the demolition division. In fact, I think they've even split up the demolition division and spread their demolition activities across three other divisions. So they appealed, and I don't know whether or not that appeal was successful. Did we ever follow up that story?
I can't remember how that panned out.
I'm not quite sure.
One of the fallouts is by the end of the year, Scrib had gone belly up.
That's right. Well, they were appealing as well.
I'm not sure I've got much sympathy with people saying, oh, it's only that little bit of the company who are being crooked. You shouldn't blame us at the top of the company. No, I think it's got to hurt. If you just find Keltbray, what is, you know, a tiny, tiny percentage of their turnover or profits, then you go, oh, well, we'll just absorb that as a cost. It's got to actually hurt to be a punishment.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I mean, as I say, they've evolved, and they had a new boss, their new CEO, a chap called Darren James. He arrived after all this had happened, apparently. So, you know, obviously he's squeaky clean. And, you know, they made a great effort to establish the fact that, you know, this is a different organisation we're talking about now. We're not the
they've all said that. Oh, this was so long ago. This was, weeks ago. Mm. Completely different organisation now. Yeah. I don't buy it. I think
no, you can't squeeze under the wire like that. It's not fair.
This was all quite pretty recent. I'm just trying to see what they've got the date.
Yeah.
Yeah, it all happened. The investigation was launched in 2019. So I think the events are happening. I've got it somewhere. It was between 2017, 2018. It was all going on.
Hmm.
And it was what I would be fascinated to know is whether the tender prices for demolition contracts have gone down since this cartel activity was busted, whether demolition is now cheaper. Because obviously, the Competition and Markets Authority listed 19 contracts, most of them in London. I mean, you know, big jobs in London.
Sure.
Some of them public sector, a lot of them private, where the demolition cost was artificially inflated by this corruption.
Hmm.
Now, Is suddenly demolition, you know, are the prices coming in a lot more competitively now? I wonder.
Yeah, it should be detectable. I mean, I know that we've had, obviously, there's been price inflation during the course of this year, and, you know, it's accelerating. So that will have closed the gap a bit. But there should be some measurable change if the cartel collusion is artificially inflating prices, either the prices should come down, or if they haven't come down, there might still be some collusion going on. So I don't know. I don't know what the figures would be on that one.
But I agree with you that story, £60 million, these 10 companies were fined for collusion. I agree that for me, that was definitely one of the biggest stories of the year. And from a business point of view, probably the biggest. The only other one I would say to rival it as a sort of a corporate story would be the collapse of Buckingham Group contracting. I mean, lots of companies obviously went bust this year. They always do. But the collapse of Buckingham in September, this is a £700 million turnover company. They were the biggest corporate casualty of the year. I mean, we're not on, you know, Carillion scale, but it's a very significant...
Yeah, they're a big name.
Very significant collapse.
I said that I wasn't... I was surprised to see this cartel being busted because, you know, it seemed to me like, you know, very old school. But actually, this stuff goes on all the time. And in fact, when we reported this, we noted that I think only in 2020 there was cartel activity in the groundworks sector, VP and MGF, which are two rival companies, you know, which provide very specialized ground support systems. They were found to be colluding, and then in the same year there was cartel activity in the roofing lead market, which I hadn't noticed at the time. Two companies, Associated Lead Mills and H.J. Endhoven, were apparently putting their heads together over that. And another one, which didn't surprise me, although I don't know, I felt that there might have been something going on there anyway, was in the precast concrete drainage sector. Three companies, their big names, Stanton Bonner, F.P. McCann and CPM. That was in 2019. They were found to be colluding. And in fact, when I discovered that story, I mean, we're looking back a few years now, I thought, oh, that explains something. There was a Dutch company which came over and started working in the UK. I wrote something about them at the time, a company called Kilstra. In fact, I went to visit. They had a yard up near Taunton, I think, and I went to visit that yard. And they had some interesting products. Well, interesting, if you can say that. You know, this is all relative. This is concrete drainage we're talking about. But yeah, they were a good company with good products. They came into the UK market and they were out of it again within 2 years, possibly even within a year. They just couldn't last. And then surprise, surprise, you find that the three biggest companies in the sector already had been colluding on prices. And so I just concluded that Kilstra must have been forced out. That, you know, the established players in the market just weren't going to have it.
Well, the biggest story is I have to go back a while, but not that long ago, 2009. What was then the Office of Fair Trading fined 103 construction companies were involved in bid rigging and cover pricing, handed down £130 million in fines. So it's always gone on, and I think it always will. And the latest one that's being investigated are the construction chemicals market. There's an investigation going on at the moment into that sector. So they'll be the, you know, I imagine we'll find out more about that next year.
Yeah. Yes, the glue people come unstuck. Anyway, shall we move on to another topic? What have you noticed? What do you want to discuss?
Well, I've got a series of government U-turns. Which are all, I think, quite big news. When you take them together, it's just a year of U-turns by the government. You mentioned HS2, huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'd already scrapped the Leeds leg a couple of years ago. But as you say, October this year, the Crewe Manchester trains were cancelled. September, if you go back a month before the HS2 thing, there's the net zero U-turn. We've talked about it in previous pods.
Yes, yeah.
The dilution, the watering down, the pushing back on deadlines for, you know, banning diesel and petrol cars and easing of restrictions on fossil fuel boilers and these sort of things.
Yes.
So that's the second U-turn. August, we had the U-turn on the abolition of CE marking, although not as it turned out, for building products. We still have to use the UCA, UKCA mark for building products. At this stage, I mean, whether that's going to change or not, I don't know. But there was a big U-turn on CE marking, which was niche but interesting. And go back further earlier in the year, in April, the smart motorways program was axed.
Yes.
That has been sort of flagged up substantially in the months and possibly years before. There have been sort of reviews and inquiries and postponements and moratorium and so on. But it was only in April this year when the government said, right, that's it. All the smart motorway projects, we're not going ahead with them. Mm. And I mean, a lot of infrastructure work. I mean, it's very handy to cut government spending just when they needed it, you know, cut infrastructure spending. So those are four big government U-turns involving the construction industry. I can guarantee there are more, but I can't remember them, and I haven't been sifting through the archives. They didn't leap out at me, but I'm sure there are other significant government U-turns.
I'm sure there must be. The one I'd noticed, the one which really alerted me, was the smart motorways one, because that was something which we discussed at length at the time. In fact, we've talked about smart motorways seldom in a positive way for several years now, actually, because it's been a long time coming, this decision. I mean, Sunak actually promised to scrap them in his during the leadership campaign back in 2022. And, you know, a lot of people breathed a sigh of relief back then, because there had been quite a concerted campaign to, you know, stop the rollout of these smart motorways. And the whole thing seemed to be thoroughly compromised by, you know, watering down already. For example, the idea that I think on they did a pilot, the first pilot smart motorway was the M42, I think, and they had refuges, because they got rid of the one of the ideas of smart motorways is that you don't have a hard shoulder anymore. Instead, you have regular, basically lay-bys, refuges. So you get into trouble, you just trundle along.
They're supposed to be every half mile, was it, or 2 miles, or what?
400 to 500 meters on the pilot project, and then when they rolled it out,
suddenly hardly anything.
That they're not free. Well, they're 2.5 kilometers between refuges. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you know, you could probably roll along 400 meters and dive into a refuge, but not 2.5 kilometers. So that was, you know, that was clearly not good. I remember Edmund King, who's is he chief executive of the AA or spokesman for the AA? Anyway?
I think he was.
He was the RAC, but he's now AA.
No, I think he was AA, sure, and he's now RAC Foundation.
Oh, really? He's a well-known campaigner. Yeah, he's a well-known campaigner in this thing. And he said that, you know, the whole smart motorway thing was a scandal, and called it motorway widening on the cheap.
Exactly what it was.
Which is exactly what it was. And he also pointed out that at least 40 people had died on smart motorways because they had to get out of their car because they'd broken down and got hit. So I don't think anybody, except maybe National Highways, actually sort of mourned the loss of the smart motorway program. I mean, in fact, National Highways said that the data still proved that they were the safest roads in the UK, and I find that hard to believe, but it's their data. So.
No, I think. What makes them safe is that it's very hard for a motorist to drive with any great confidence at more than sort of 75 miles an hour. Now, I know a lot of people, I'm not one of them, of course, who will come off drive along the M25 at code compliant legal speed of 70 miles an hour because there are cameras all the way. Then they get onto the M26 heading towards Dover, and there are no cameras. So, oh, great, put their foot down, perhaps clock up a ton, and then hit the M20 where the cameras are back, and then screech back down to 70 again. So, of course, if you've got people driving with impunity, not immunity, at excess speeds, there will be accidents will happen. So I think roads with cameras, with speed cameras, are probably safer. Mm. Roads with no hard shoulders are not safer, but they haven't actually divided those two crucial bits of the, you know, crucial ingredients apart. They've just sort of conflated them and said, oh, they're safer.
I think another characteristic of smart motorways was this sort of variable speed limit as well, wasn't it? And you notice that particularly on something like the M25, which is prone to congestion.
That's all right, though. They work. They work. If everyone drives...
They do. Well, I've noticed a lot of people don't take no notice of the temporary speed limit. You know, you're going along and it says 60 miles an hour over on the gantry. A couple of miles further down the road, it says 50, and then it's down to 40. People are still going 70. And it's the same with the... Last time I got caught speeding, it was on one of those stretches where it's reduced to 50 miles an hour and you're basically clocked in and clocked out. So don't spend
average,
enough
average
time...
Average speed check.
Yeah, average speed limit. Yeah, exactly. And that's, for me, that works because I never exceed 50 miles an hour in one of those. Not anymore. But a lot of people do, and I don't know if they're getting nabbed as a result of it.
So that was the last time you done speeding, was it, David? How long ago was that?
Well, that's a long time ago. A long, long time ago.
How many times have you been done for speeding?
Oh, I don't know. Lost count, Phil.
Dear. Never happened to me, Gov. I daren't say this out loud because it'll come back to bite me, but I've been stopped about four times and never once done. I've always managed to talk my way out of it.
Oh, you have to coach me then, Phil. I've never actually been stopped and questioned. I've just had a notice through the post. Oh no, it's one of those.
Oh, I had those notices. I had to in the deepest depth of the very first lockdown, I had to make an emergency visit to central London, and it was fabulous. I managed to drive straight through, you know, the Square Mile, the Bank of England and Threadneedle, you know, all these, it was the shortest route, no traffic, middle of the day. I thought they were filming some sort of, you know, Danny Boyle zombie horror film or something. It's just like apocalypse. There's no one there. And I was driving through. And this is fantastic.
Mm,
all the lights going green as I went through. Not many days later, suddenly all these tickets started landing on my mat. I've been driving down streets that cars weren't allowed down unless you were a taxi or a bus. But there were no queues to kind of, all I could see was big wide roads ahead, empty. And I thought, just go straight down there. Now, if you're driving in busy traffic, you can see where all the traffic's going and you're kind of alerted to knowing where you're supposed to go and where you're not supposed to go. And I'm sure I wouldn't have made that mistake. And I wasn't, you know, being cynical, thinking, oh, you know, never mind, flout the rules, I'll get away with it. It was total innocent error, not knowing what the routes you can and can't drive down in the Square Mile. So that cost me a fair bit.
Well, you can go as fast as you like on the motorways now because there are no smart ones. Well, that's not quite true.
The cameras will stay.
The cameras will stay, yeah. But that was a significant U-turn, I agree. Very much so. There's another big story which broke in May, but I mean, most of the news didn't filter out until September, and that was the problem of reinforced, aerated, autoclave concrete.
RAC.
RAC.
Or RARC, as you call it.
RARC. I think we agreed that we should call it RARC, but everybody else calls it RAC. Yeah, that was a big construction story, and in a way, that came out of the blue, but we should have known about it.
It
crawled out of the blue. No, I think we first reported on it in May, and this was when what was it? There was a school
it was
in
earlier than that. I'm just going to see.
Do you think so?
But when did we first mention? Okay.
No, I wrote a feature in the magazine about it in May, but no, that was following news reports. What was it?
The first mention we had of it was in 2021 on our website.
Right, okay. That was when a ceiling in a school had collapsed.
Yeah, but we actually...
Luckily when...
No, 2021 was... I don't think even reported on that. It was we're just in reference to a hospital being rebuilt because of the... discovery of RAC panels in the roof.
Yeah.
But actually, we should have been, we obviously weren't doing our job. We should have been writing about it back in 2019 was when the school building collapsed.
Really?
And that's when the Standing Committee on Structural Safety, they put out their an alert in 2019. The Local Government Association put out something about then, if not before. when was the, I'm trying to think when the, that Gravesend school, 2018 was the school roof
Good
collapse.
Gracious.
Which we didn't report on.
Wow.
Mea culpa.
No. Well, it was probably because it was a small, you know, a small building fault in a school somewhere, and nobody at the time really appreciated what the ramifications were.
That's it. It's all about the implications, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, over the course of this year, we've discovered that Iraq is just about everywhere. You know, it's this stuff. It looks like the inside of a crunchy bar. And it's
not as golden.
Not as golden or as tasty. But yeah, it's a very, very spongy, lightweight concrete. And, you know, we have aircrete blocks. We're not those alike. But these are panels, obviously, for those who don't know. And I'm sure there can't be many who don't know what a rack panel is by now. Yeah, they are a couple of meters long, maybe 3 meters long, up to a meter wide, something like that. They're reinforced. They've got a little bit of rebar in them, but they're porous, obviously, because of all the holes in this sort of foamy texture.
Well, ironically, the rebar is part of the problem, of course, because it...
Well, of course, because...
It corrodes.
Yeah, yeah. And then the concrete spalls and it loses its strength, what strength it had. And then, of course, it falls. And if somebody's walking on a roof, for example, which is covered with this stuff, they can go through it. And, of course, the big news broke in September, just before schools were going back after the summer break, when the government... So suddenly told, I think it was 104 schools that had been detected as having had rack panels in part of the buildings. A week before the start of the school year, yeah, the Department for Education told schools to close the buildings which were affected and move into temporary accommodation, or sort of, I don't know, bundle them all into one room which wasn't affected. And so that was terrible timing and caused a great brouhaha.
I mean, there'd been quite a big thing. It was in the news earlier on in the year because they used the rack issue. It was already becoming a crisis in the hospital universe.
Yes.
They rejigged the whole hospital building program and they pushed the most crumbly hospitals higher up the list because they suddenly thought, oh,
that's right.
These panels, we know they need replacing, but we didn't realise how urgent it is to get out of these buildings. So they rejigged that program. And that's what sparked the whole big investigation of schools over the summer holidays. And it seems like it transpired that someone somewhere had been using, had had their spreadsheet upside down or using the wrong equation, the wrong formula. And they suddenly realized that actually they'd got all their sums wrong. It's a bit like using inches instead of centimetres.
Well, somebody had been doing surveys using the assumption that rack had the same structural qualities as normal, structural concrete. So, it weighs far less than normal concrete because of all the air in it. And I think it was some engineer, I don't know who it was he anonymous? Suddenly sort of came out and said people had been using the wrong codes.
It was what used to be called the Standing Committee on Structural Safety, now, the Collaborative Reporting for Safer Structures, CROSS, which is all anonymous. I mean, they based on them on anonymous reports, they put out something saying that, the calculations supposedly based on Eurocodes used a proprietary software package and the parameters treated the rack as if it was normal structural concrete. So your point, they had the wrong compressive strength in, and that threw out all the numbers because, rubbish in, rubbish out. And when that happened, they suddenly thought, oh my God, we've got all our numbers wrong. Better not go into those school buildings.
Mm. Yeah. And of course, it's not just schools and hospitals. There were theatres and police stations and presumably lots of other public buildings, and it's probably still loads and loads of rack ceilings getting ready to fall down all over the country. But
I mean, we talk quite a lot about that back in one of our September podcasts, didn't we? So I think we'll move on. Well, so one of my moving on slightly. Well, this isn't at all frivolous. It's quite an important story, but it's quirky story, I guess. Is in July. Marks and Spencer's were told by Michael Gove that they weren't allowed to knock down their Oxford Street flagship department store. Yes. M&S want to knock it down and build something better. This is not a listed building. It's of no particular architectural merit in the context of the West End of London. And they want to build something rather grander and greener. And Gove said, well, no, that's just wasteful. You've got a perfectly good building there. Just, you know, make it better. You can't go around knocking things down without no good reason. And the bit I liked about this story the most is the boss of M&S calling the decision utterly pathetic. The sort of reaction you like to hear from people. Normally they'll sort of go grumble, grumble, grumble. That's if he's a football manager, he'd probably be sent to the stands for that kind of insubordination. But you're allowed to call ministers and their decisions utterly pathetic.
I felt some sympathy actually with Gove on this one. I thought he had quite a good point. I mean, because this building, I can't remember how old it is, but it's not ancient. No. I mean, it's not sort of past its use by date or anything like that. It's just that Marks and Spencer. I mean, it's their flagship store, so obviously, they want the best they can get, and they had these grandiose plans to build this wonderful, beautiful architecturally designed building, which had, I don't know, BREEAM excellent qualities and was sort of the cutting edge of sustainable construction. But in order to have that, they need to demolish and get rid of a perfectly serviceable building. And I think Gove is quite right to say, before you start doing something like this, you should try and improve what you already have. And it's a far better use of resources. Actually, this is another topic which has sort of bubbled to the surface several times throughout the year, is this idea of circularity is becoming a very, very fashionable thing to talk about. And it's very much sort of on the tip of people's tongues when they're talking, it used to be sustainability and then it was net zero. Now we're talking about circularity and the circular economy. We've written quite a lot over the year about materials passports. The idea that, you should have these buildings which are, where you know exactly which materials went into them so that at the end of their life, you can deconstruct them and reuse those materials and you'll know exactly what the materials are and what their properties are and you can reuse them.
Trace their provenance.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's becoming more and more accepted. I think it's accepted anyway, but I mean, it's becoming more prominent, I think, in discussions about sustainable construction. And Gove was basically channeling that when he told Marks and Spencer that they couldn't knock down their flagship store, because that goes against the whole spirit of this circularity idea. I mean, presumably they would say, oh yeah, well, we'll recycle all the masonry and all the steel and all the rest of it. It's not quite the same thing. You're still wasting materials. And Gove said, no, just make it better, improve it.
Thing is, to improve it, how they need to improve it, what they need to do, if they can't knock it down, is leave the facade standing and absolutely gut it from the inside. Because the floors...
Which is standard practice, especially in London.
I must have been in that store, but I can't say with any certainty, but an awful lot of department stores of that vintage, and even younger, have got really, really low ceilings because all the modern services that have now gone in. And when you go into a department store with low ceilings, you don't really feel... They look dumpy and pitty, and you just tend to have a negative view of most of the products on sale. And it's not a great showcase for selling goods when you're in these sort of really low-ceilinged department stores. They're rubbish, frankly. Mm-hmm. So I can understand the Marks & Spencer, if their store is like that, which I imagine it is. They would need to gut out the whole thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Only to retain the facade. And yet the facade has no merit, no value.
No, that's true.
So I see both sides. In general, I think I said before, I'm a big fan in life of doing nothing. I think doing nothing is is ecologically sound.
Yeah, that's true. It
conserves energy.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about conserving energy and all things green, of course, hydrogen has been one of the elements that we've been reporting on quite a lot this year. And there was, companies like JCB. JCB in the plant world are very pro-hydrogen. They've done a lot in that respect. But one of the big stories about hydrogen, which I think actually backfired, was this announcement by National Highways. That was in July, I believe, June or July. National Highways, of course, whose Lower Thames Crossing project is perennially in the news. They announced that all their heavy plant was going to be hydrogen powered on the project. I don't know if they announced that because they wanted to score some points with the green lobby and maybe deflect some of the objections to the project. But they said they'll be replacing diesel with hydrogen to fuel heavy construction machinery on the project to make it carbon neutral. So they reckoned that this massive infrastructure project would be made carbon neutral. I mean, this is the way I read it, that this huge project would be carbon neutral simply by getting rid of diesel and using hydrogen. And then it emerged. In actual fact, they'd only replace a third of the diesel, and they'd still need, I think it was 40 million litres of diesel to finish the job. So it was a classic case of greenwashing, and they were called out almost immediately by various campaign groups and other people whose eyes were on what was going on here. So I don't know if they're still claiming that they're going to have a carbon neutral project. But that one backfired, I reckon.
Well, no, they're big on it. They published a tender in just the end of last month, shortlisted. Say not published a tender. They published a shortlist for four companies to supply 6 million kilograms of hydrogen for the project.
So they're serious about it.
They still say they want to do it. Replacing 20 million litres of diesel, as you say, but still not replacing millions more litres. But yeah. it's a project which is so ungreen that they're trying to sort of, as you say, decorate around the edges to do whatever they can to make it less bad. Although it's a piece of essential transport infrastructure, I'm all for it.
Yeah?
Because I'm stuck in this little corner of Kent and can't get out.
Okay, I'm getting towards the end of my list actually of favoured jobs. Anything else? We've mentioned HS2 being cancelled. That was obviously a massive.
Well, we haven't mentioned the whole Category 1 modern method of construction volumetric house builders.
Oh yeah, there's a lot happened in that sector. Yeah,
yeah, and we've talked about this a lot before. Legal & General pulled out. Ilka went bust, taking £68 million of my money with it. And then the government decides to lend another £15 million to Top Hat, which is owned by Goldman Sachs and Persimmon and Aviva. So there was actually, I listened to about half an hour, 40 minutes of a couple of bods from Homes England and the construction minister, Lee Rowley, giving evidence to a House of Lords inquiry into MMC, into modern methods of construction.
No, that was quite recently, wasn't it? Yes.
And now, what's his name? The guy who's, is he chief exec or chief investment, chief strategy man or whatever at Homes England, David Bridges, or Bridgen, he used to work for Kia Homes.
Okay.
He's now at Homes England. And the peers on this committee were saying, say, if you've lost all this money on Ilka and you lost money on urban splash homes, modular homes, a year before or a couple of years before, what lessons have you learned? Because you're still lending money to these people. And I wasn't entirely convinced by the answers to this. He said, with some justification, this guy, David Bidgen or Bidges, whatever his name is, Homes England, their job is to intervene where there's a market failure and go where private investment won't. They're sort of, the lender of last resort. And also to catalyse private sector investment to sort of
encourage others.
Confidence into the market.
Yeah.
He said, as for the losing 68 million when Ilka went down, he said, it's certainly not something we're happy with. But he went on to sort of justify it by saying, but it's only represents 3.5% of our long-term spend on these things, so it doesn't. Yes, no big deal. We're still up. We're still
that's
doing
petty
fine.
Cash.
And he quite sweetly passed the buck by saying, "Well, in our due diligence, we use very strong professional advisors. PwC, EY, BDO, which for those who don't know their acronyms, PricewaterhouseCooper, Ernst & Young, and I don't know what BDO stands for.
No, I don't know.
But anyway, so it's, you know, we're paying lots of money for the most expensive advice we can get. So we must be doing the right thing, even though we're losing all this money lending.
I think EY were Carillion's auditor, weren't they?
Touché, good point. I think you might be right. But he said the only sort of lesson they do sort of take away is they don't want to lend to people who are too early on the journey. If you or I go along and say, we're thinking of building, we want to build one of these Lego factories, can we have lots of money, please? They'll go, no. Prove yourself first, get something up and running and sell. And you know, when you start looking like a winner, then we might come and back you.
Okay.
But I think Ilka was already at that stage, certainly the second tranche that that Homes England put in. He did reveal that we chose not to invest in Legal & General. So I don't know what Legal & General had done wrong that Ilka had done right and Top Hat had done right, why they chose not to invest in Legal & General.
Maybe it's because Legal & General, of course, aren't, you know, Ilke and Top Hat and the rest of them, they're all, basically, that's what they do. They just do off-site manufacturing. Legal & General, I mean, it was a sort of a side hustle for them, wasn't it? Doing, building off-site houses.
I suppose.
So maybe they thought that, you know, you've got, you know, this is just one string to your bow. You know, we don't need to support it.
Well, I would have thought it's your Legal & General. What do you need us for? You're bigger than we are.
Well, yes, that's true, yeah.
But that didn't hold when they were talking to Goldman Sachs. It's, Goldman Sachs, oh, you poor things. You've hardly got any money at all. Of course, have some of our money. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I wasn't into – I admit I didn't it was about an hour and a half, 2 hours long they went on for, and I didn't stay to the end. It seemed to be going around in circles. And normally in these things, they say anything they're going to say within the first half hour anyway. But I wasn't hugely comforted and encouraged by what they said. So it would be interesting to read the final report from this House of Lords Built Environment Committee when it comes out next year.
Yeah.
And anyway, all of that is an update on stuff we've talked about before on what's going on with these volumetric house builders.
That rumbles on. I'm sure there'll be more of that next year, though.
Oh, yeah. Other stories. Yeah, government launched in May. The government launched an investigation into, quote, industrial-scale corruption on Teesside. This is the Teesside Development Corporation. The mayor there, Ben Houchen, or Lord Houchen, I think he now is it. Boris Johnson put him in the House of Lords, is his dealings with local businessmen who are paying not very much for land and doing quite well out of grants and... careful what I say here, but if you read Private Eye, folks, they've been running the full story on this in depth for ages, to such an extent that eventually, I think probably a Labour MP stood up in the House of Commons and started reading from Private Eye, and the government had nowhere to hide when that, because it's all protected, deep privilege and so on, and Gove said, we'll launch an investigation. Nothing more has been said about that investigation. One assumes it's ongoing, but I imagine there'll be a change of government before anything comes out, in which case they'll probably investigation will really get going because it'll be a Labour government investigation, a Tory-controlled mayor.
Yes. Yeah, more of an incentive there. That was an interesting one. Towards the end of the year, there's one story which I particularly liked, which was this chap who's the chief executive of the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, Nick Smallwood. He was giving evidence at a...
We talked about this a couple of months ago, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Saying that post-pandemic working from home was causing delays to UK infrastructure projects. Yeah, I suppose we shouldn't go into too much detail about this because I think it was probably the last podcast we discussed it. But yeah, they basically held a wet finger in the air and said, working from home is adding between 9 and 12 months to the design process for our major infrastructure projects. And there didn't seem to be much evidence or sort of data to back up this this assumption. But of course, Phil, you and I both work from home and have done for several years. And I don't know how productive we'd be if we worked in an office together, but I suspect probably not as productive as we are in our own little silos.
I suspect our work would take longer, but it would be of a higher quality.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, because we were looking over each other's shoulders.
And competing.
And competing, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, we should mention the building safety regulator opened for business. This room in the Health and Safety Executive, all part of the Building Safety Act and the new regulatory regime for tall buildings, buildings of higher risk buildings. And that's all started. In a similar vein, also in April, we had the publication of the Independent Review of Construction Product Testing, written by Paul Morell, the former construction advisor to the government, and Annalise Day, a barrister. But we've heard nothing. That's just kind of like landed on the desk and
yes,
I haven't heard anything since. I don't know whether the government are planning on picking up and running with it and doing anything with it, or anything's going to change, or whether it's just going to be, you know, thanks, now I can keep that door open with that doorstop there.
Probably. Yeah. Well, that's all, yes, this is all sort of post-Grenfell stuff, isn't it? And when did the Act come into force, the Building Safety Act? Was that this year or was that last year?
I think that was last year, wasn't it? Wasn't that 2022?
Yeah. I'm getting all my years muddled up here.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. The Act came in last year, and then, yes, the regulator was established this year, in April, that's right.
Building Safety Act 2022, Dr. Google tells me. Yes, that should be ingrained. I'm ashamed I had to look that up.
Yes.
Here's a quiz question for you.
Go on.
What tall object did we see for the first time this year, and it appeared in Somerset?
Ah, yes. Not as tall as I thought it was going to be is the answer to that one. Well, no, the answer to that one is the T-pylon.
Correct.
Yeah, the T-pylon. Yeah, which I thought, it won a design competition, didn't it?
Yeah,
because
that's it.
These are the pylons which carry all the electricity from, or will carry all the electricity from the new Hinkley Point C nuclear power station to the grid, connect it to the grid. And, it wasn't EDF, it must have been the government, wanted to, or was it National Grid?
National Grid.
Yeah.
Or some
division
of National Grid.
Wanted some nice, elegant pylons. They didn't like those lattice ones, which we've got everywhere else, and they wanted something new and sleek and attractive.
I'm sure cheap probably must come into there secretly somewhere as well.
Yeah, pylons. These are the shape of things to come. You see, because this is all new, brand new electricity from a brand new nuclear power station. They wanted brand new pylons to carry them along. Anyway, so they started putting them in this year, and anybody going up and down the M5 motorway in sort of Somerset will have seen these. They're as I said, they're not like the lattice ones. You know, you think of a tower crane. Well, you don't have to think of a tower crane because. Because electricity pylons are far more common. anyway, lattice towers, as they're known. They're fine. Yeah, I like them. I've got no problem with that. But I was very disappointed when I saw the first T-pylons because they are deliberately actually quite shorter, so they don't sort of loom up on the horizon. They hug the ground a bit more. And they are sort of like mono pile type things. They've got a single tower, and then they're T-shaped,
double-headed lampposts.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah, I think quite a lot of people have been disappointed that they don't look like their pictures exactly, do they?
No, they don't. They don't. They look a bit stocky and squat, actually. And
nothing wrong with that, David.
Well, you know. There's a place for everything, Phil. But when we're talking about electricity pylons, I think squatty and stock and squatty.
I wouldn't make a very electricity pylon.
Stocky and squat. Yeah. No, it doesn't work. Not for a pylon. I think they need to be tall and elegant and proud.
Like you.
So yeah. That was my big disappointment of the year. It was the arrival of the T pylons.
Right, well, I'm running out of things on my list.
Well, me too. I think a lot more happened. There's no doubt about it. There was another thing which I suppose I sort of associated. I thought it came under the same bracket as the rack panels, which was quite an interesting little story back in June, that the Institution of Structural Engineers had updated its design codes for car parks. Do you remember that one?
Yep, because cars are getting heavier.
And that was, they've been using the same design code since 1976, apparently. And
Multi-storey car parks, we should say.
Yes, multi-storey car parks, not sort of ground level ones. But anybody will have noticed in a car park of a certain age that manoeuvring in and out of the space can be quite difficult because there isn't enough room. You know, modern cars are bigger, they're wider, and they're heavier.
I have no problem parking my car. I can get into those tiny little spaces. I just then have to get out the boot.
Well, yes, that's true. Yeah, because you can't open the door. Although I think some Teslas, don't they have doors that sort of go up vertically?
Gull wings.
Yeah, not quite gull wings. They pop out a couple of inches and then go straight up. So you can get out of I think I might be wrong. It does overcome that problem if you're parked too close to the car next door. But yeah, that is one of the problems. You have to get out through the boot. But the biggest problem, of course, from a structural point of view, is the fact that cars are much heavier now. They're not any bigger. They're obviously much heavier as well. And the story that you posted, you quoted a few figures. A 1991 Ford Escort weighs just over a ton, 1,045 kilograms. A 2023 Ford Focus, which of course is the successor to the Escort, that weighs half as much again. That's 1.5 tons. And if you're looking at a sort of crossover SUV like a Ford Cougar, that's nudging 2 tons, as is a Tesla Model 3. And of course, electric cars have these massive batteries in them, which are extremely heavy. And so, as we shift more towards electric cars, the weight of a car for a given size is going to increase. And so, yeah, the Institution of Structural Engineers decided that they needed to beef up their design codes in order to cope with this. And I think actually there had been one or two incidents. I mean, there have been one or two incidents of electric cars burning up in multi-storey car parks. There was one at, was it Gatwick Airport recently?
No, I think it was discovered that wasn't an electric car. Didn't it come out it wasn't electric?
Behind on that one.
Dodgy ground here, but I remember there's much speculation about, because people want to sort of go, oh, bloody modern things. I have a feeling it came out that it wasn't, but I may be wrong. So,
Right. There was a multi-storey car park in the States. I think it was in New York City, which actually collapsed. And I don't think anybody was killed, but a lot of cars were written off as a result of that. And that they reckoned was due to overloading. So clearly, I hope we're not going to have the same situation as we've got with rack beams, that, you're going to have to strengthen or avoid or close completely multi-storey car parks all over the country because they can't cope with the weight of the vehicles. But they are getting, presumably there is a margin for error built into the design, but they've had to adjust that in order to take account of the heavier cars that we drive these days.
There's one final innovation which we've seen this year, or I would say a development on an existing product, because as we know, there's nothing new in the sun. It's all about science and engineering and technology. Mm-hmm. It's all about taking something that already exists and moving it forward by making it just a little bit better. And you don't know what I'm talking about, do you?
I'll give
you a clue. It's actually something that comes from the House of Construction Index that's emerged this month, new on the market.
Yeah, indeed, yes, I do. I know what you're talking about now, Phil. Yes,
have you managed to obtain a game of what do you call it? A box of construction Monopoly.
Yep, I have indeed, yes. I mean, obviously, as we're approaching the festive season, which is this traditional time for...
Gifts and board games.
Gifts and board games. There is one available now for those who are construction-minded, which is the Construction Index own version of Monopoly. I say it's Construction Index's own. We haven't sort of cobbled together something homemade. This is done in association with...
Hasbro.
Yeah, Hasbro. I couldn't remember who it was. Yeah, special edition.
Well, I actually received my copy. It's not called a copy. What do you call my box?
Your box, yeah. Box will do.
At the weekend. And I thought, I'm going to leave that. I know what that is. I can tell by the shape and the weight and the rattle. I'm going to leave that wrapped up under the tree and open it on Christmas Day. So at least I know I have one thing to open. I used to play an awful lot of Monopoly as a child, but I don't recall ever actually finishing a game. So I'm looking forward to playing as a grown-up. I don't think I've ever played as a grown-up because I'm the youngest of four children.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so there would be a lot of board games, more often than not, I would say Monopoly. And being the youngest of four, I was the one that, before too long, would be throwing a tantrum at having to shell out all this money and missing out on things, that I would, of course, throw the whole thing onto the floor and storm off in a huff.
Oh, Phil, I never had you down for that sort of behaviour.
Youngest, that's the
You've
role.
Grown and, out of it. You've
the role and duties of youngest children.
Well, I've never been, I have to say, I've never been a great board game enthusiast. We didn't really play them much when I was a kid, but my kids love them, and they're all coming home. I say kids, the youngest one's 24. They'll love this when they get home at Christmas. So we'll all sit around the table playing Construction Monopoly, and I'm sure a wonderful time will be had by all.
I'm looking forward to seeing what the chance and community chess cards are, because I remember them all being, you know, you've won a beauty contest, you win, or
yes,
you've won £50 or £10 or that. The sum's always very low. What now apparently is different about Monopoly? Nothing is pounds anymore. It's all the pound sign doesn't exist. It's all M's. It's a sort of, it's like a sort of a Monopoly's own currency.
Ten.
It's like the what's that language we're all supposed to be talking in the future?
Esperanto.
It's like some sort of Esperanto currency called an M. So if people look at their new Monopoly and think, "Hang on a minute, this is a misprint." It's not. That's the modern way.
It's a board game equivalent of Bitcoin, I assume.
Yeah, yes.
it's entirely virtual.
I believe the rule, as I say, I haven't opened my set yet. I believe the rules and the concept is all the same. I don't know whether you're buying, building houses and hotels or offices and depots or whatever.
Hmm.
But I always felt the best thing about the Monopoly set was the counters, the Scotty dog and the iron,
the little
boots.
Pewter top hat and stuff like that.
That's it. That's always what made Monopoly.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure we've got some
with that. I've seen all the photos of the little counters. We don't have Scotty dogs and top hats. We've got a Komatsu dumper truck, a JCB backhoe loader, a Takeuchi mini excavator, a Mechalac site dumper, a Bridgestone tire, and curiously, a tiltrotator, which is a little die-cast thing the size of a dice, looks like something from outer space.
Good gracious! Well, yeah. Well, I haven't opened my set yet, so I haven't actually had a chance to actually handle what's inside. But that would be interesting. And I suppose, yeah, certainly a tiltrotator will probably raise a few eyebrows. What the hell is this, for example?
Well, I'm going to bag to be the tire, I think. I'd be the one that I want to be, because it's probably the most, when you grip it, it'd be, I don't know, something about tires. quiz question. You'll know this. Do you know, I mentioned Bridgestone, you've got Goodyear and you've got the, and so on and so forth. Do you know who makes more tires than anyone else in the world? The world's biggest tire manufacturer by units?
It'll be Chinese. I'm pretty sure of that. But I don't know any Chinese tyre makers. Am I half right?
I'm going to surprise you then. No. The world's biggest tyre manufacturer or the manufacturer of the most amount of tyres is Lego.
Really? Mind you, they're an awful lot smaller than most tyres.
Fact that I've read, so I seem to
say. Yeah, okay.
Right. I think we're done. You need to, you're not getting your treat of the weekend. I need to go write some Christmas cards.
Yes, you do. Yes, and I need to make that journey up to the loft to get down all the decorations. But I'm saving that until the weekend, as I said.
Okay, so that's episode number 142 of Reconstruction Done and Dusted, David, which if we assume that we've averaged about 45 minutes an episode, and we often guess on for rather longer than that, that works out at somewhere around 106 hours, or about 4.5 days we've now been talking.
God, that's an awful lot of hot air, Phil.
It is. Thank you, regular listeners, for joining us once again. And we would like to wish you a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and however you celebrate the season, have fun, and don't do anything I wouldn't do. So from David and I, cheerio.
Cheerio. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.